America's future depends on energy independence. That's why President Donald Trump unleashed American energy, and we are today energy independent for the first time in 70 years.
On one of his first decisions as president to cancel the permits for the planned Keystone Pipeline, which was to carry oil from the tar sands of Canada to the United States.
Joe Biden comes in as president of the United States and shuts down the Keystone Pipeline. They've been denying, the Interior Department been in the process of denying any additional pipeline leases, and yet they approved the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that will be an enormous boon to Russia.
War breaks out in Ukraine after Russia launches a full-scale attack hitting cities and military bases with more than 100 ballistic missiles.
Welcome to American Freedom, sponsored by Young America's Foundation. We're coming to you today from the great state of Indiana. This is former Vice President Mike Pence. In 2008, the Russian military invaded Georgia, and their tanks are still on those grounds today. In 2014, the world watched as Russia invaded Crimea and claimed a portion of Ukraine as its own. When our administration took office, we went straight to work to rebuild our military, make the strongest military in the history of the world stronger still. We opposed a gas pipeline between Europe and Russia called Nord Stream 2, and we didn't hesitate to use military power to prosecute America's interests, firing cruise missiles into Russia's ally Syria when they used chemical weapons. We took action to take down ISIS, took out Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and took out Qasem Soleimani, the most dangerous terrorist in the world. But from the advent of the Biden administration, things have changed. After ending the Keystone Pipeline and oil and gas leases in this country, they approved the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. They reopened negotiations for the Iran nuclear deal. And of course, all of us watched the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan in August of last year. You know, there is a truth of history that weakness arouses evil. And as we speak, just a little less than a week ago, the Russian military moved once again across the border, attempting to redraw international lines by force, invading Ukraine. And as we gather for this edition of American Freedom, we do so at a time that literally thousands of civilians have lost their lives. The fighting is ongoing. And I thought as we hold up the ideal of freedom in this country, now more than ever, we ought to hear from two people that I deeply respect. On American Freedom today, we'll hear from the Heritage Foundation's leading foreign policy and defense expert. But starting out of the gate is a man that I had the great privilege of serving in the White House with. He was the national security advisor for President Donald Trump. He is now at the Hoover Institution. He's a PhD in military history. He's a widely admired and award-winning author. But more than anything else, he is a patriot who has served this nation in and out of uniform with incredible distinction. And he is my friend, H.R. McMaster. Welcome to American Freedom.
Hey, Mr. Vice President. It is great to see you again. Let me just begin by thanking you for your leadership and your example and your mentorship and guidance. You know, when I was in the job as National Security Advisor, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you helping me do the best job I could for you, the president, and the country in that job. So thank you. Great to see you.
Well, it's great to see you. And you did a phenomenal job. I think of our record. I think of the strong stands our administration took, particularly the efforts to rebuild the military, restore the arsenal of democracy. And now I know that your opinions are much in demand right now. H.R. McMaster, give us your broad reaction to what's taking place in Ukraine at this very hour with the Russian military storming across that country.
Well, Mr. Vice President, you know, there are things that we call black swans because they surprise us. And there are things that are pink flamingos because they were really obvious and we should have paid attention to them. And I think this is the latter. I think you raised the issue of our failure to deter Vladimir Putin. And that failure to deter is associated with a perception of weakness. I think if you think of deterrence as a simple equation of capability times will, I think Vladimir Putin has concluded that our will is just about zero. And that's tied to, as you mentioned, the disastrous surrender to a terrorist organization and withdrawal from Afghanistan. And you can draw a direct line from that, I think, to the coercion of Ukraine beginning last summer with the massing of troops on the borders and the threat of a renewed invasion. Because we have to remember, he annexed Crimea and invaded Eastern Ukraine in 2014. Right. And I would just point out, in terms of this failure to deter, back then, that decision, I think, was directly related to the unenforced red line in Syria, 2013 to 2014.
Had to be. And
Vladimir Putin concluded, okay, hey, the Americans aren't going to do anything.
It literally just followed that. I want our listeners to know that H.R. McMaster is with us, everybody. It was literally in the weeks and months after President Obama did not enforce the red line in Syria. He said, if Syria used chemical weapons, that's a red line. There will be consequences. But nothing happened. And shortly after that, they moved into Crimea, right?
Right. And the response to that was very weak as well. I mean, it was almost a full year before there were even any economic sanctions there. And I'll tell you, I really think that sense of American weakness also is connected to China accelerating their island building in the South China Sea. Happened in 2014 as well. The subsequent decision to weaponize those islands and lay claim to the ocean, right? The part of the ocean through which one third of the world's surface trade flows. And so, you know, I think that we are responding better now, but the issue is we're responding and we lost the opportunity to deter Russia because Putin will push as hard as he can until he meets strong resistance. And he's been doing that, you know, since he took over in 2000, but especially after 2007. And it'd be, I think, important for your listeners to go back to the speech that he made in 2007 in the Munich Security Conference. And he laid out his objective, which was to restore Russia to national greatness and to do that, especially by establishing his control over the former territories of the Soviet Union. What happened next? Massive cyber attacks on Estonia, 2007. The invasion of Georgia in 2008. And what did we do during this period of time? We continued to disarm, essentially, by reductions to the defense budget. We've created a bow wave of deferred military modernization. We shrunk the size of our force, and we kept drawing down our force in Europe, even though Russia was becoming more and more aggressive. So it was the opposite of the Reagan peace through strength. I mean, I think we felt as if maybe we could achieve peace through weakness, you know, but it doesn't work that way.
Well, there was a great sense, I thought, during our administration, and you were a tremendous advisor to the president during those early days, the rebuilding of the military, the modernizing of our military. And is there any doubt in your mind that the decision to fire cruise missiles into Syria in response to them crossing the red line, the movement against ISIS taking out Baghdadi, is there any doubt in your mind that in our 4 years, Putin knew that we would not hesitate? We had a president and administration that would not hesitate to act to prosecute our interests, and that served as a deterrence in that period to some degree?
I believe it did restore deterrence, and it restored deterrence, I would say, with the Iranians to a large extent as well. And how do I know that? Why do I think that? Well, remember the Obama administration invited the Russians into Syria because instead of enforcing the red line, they said, oh, help us, you know, come into Syria and help the Syrians get rid of their chemical weapons. Well, how did that work out? They didn't do it. And then what Russia began to do is enable the serial episodes of mass homicide, which is the Syrian civil war. Right. And they felt like they could get away with anything there. And the attack that they made, this is also very important, Mr. Vice President, not only the response in April of 2017, when we fired the cruise missiles to take out the aircraft that committed this mass murder attack, where, I mean, over a thousand innocents were murdered, including over 500 children.
Right.
And so this was to... This was to dissuade him from ever doing that again, but then also to take out their capacity to do it. You might also, I know you remember, the February 2018 Russian mercenary attack on our special forces, during which we killed, over 400 of the enemy who attacked us, but over 200 Russian mercenaries. And this was all aimed at gaining control of oil fields and a Conoco oil facility. So so that the Russians could begin to finance the rebuilding of the country they helped to destroy.
But that was one of those moments. You're exactly right. And it's in, not only do I remember it well, but I remember the Secretary of Defense said our military in the field, a relatively small group of Americans, 50 or 60 American military, we had hundreds of soldiers moving against them, including several hundred Russian mercenaries. And they were warned once, warned twice, warned three times. And Secretary Mattis said, gave the order, take them out. And they did. But that kind of willingness to use American force to defend our troops, defend our interests, was a deterrence in your mind.
It was absolutely a deterrence. And I think we've lost that now to mm-hmm. a large degree, right. As you mentioned, based on the humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan and also the stated desire to disengage from complex problem sets abroad. And of course, this affects, I think, you know, both political parties now at this stage. There's a sense, I think, on maybe portions of both political parties that our disengagement from these complex contests abroad, competitions abroad, is an unmitigated good. But I think what we learned from 9/11, right, is these challenges that develop abroad can only be dealt with at an exorbitant cost once they reach our shores. And I think we see that with COVID-19 as another example, right? It would have been best dealt with abroad. But of course, the Chinese did everything they could to prevent the international effort to contain an epidemic before it became a pandemic.
You know, HR, it's one of the HR McMaster is with us, everybody. Former national security advisor in the Trump-Pence administration and a distinguished military career now at the Hoover Institution. You know, I remember when the president had me go speak at the Munich Security Conference just a few months into our administration. And there was a great deal of concern about President Trump's posture about NATO and our European alliances, because he was tough on them. He said, you all need to live up to your obligations. But before we left office, literally over $100 billion more in military spending. And I just took note in the last several days, Germany announced that they are going to increase their military spending up to the 2% commitment, which they were unwilling to do before 2030. And so in a very real sense, I look back at those times and I think President Trump exercised some very tough language on the NATO alliance, said you need to step up. Many of them did step up. But this Russian aggression seems to have accelerated and strengthen NATO, which is exactly the opposite of what Putin was looking for, right?
Absolutely. What he wanted was disunity. He's getting unity. And, you know, you're right. Absolutely right about this, Mr. Vice President, is that this was, I think, a very positive aspect of President Trump's approach toward NATO and Secretary General Stoltenberg, who we see leading the alliance through the crisis. You know, he really appreciated that about President Trump. And I would sometimes be on the phone with him to say, you know, to say that, you know, what the president wants is a strong alliance, right? And he agreed and was grateful for it. And finally, Germany is waking up to it. I just hope it's not too late. You know, George Marshall had this great saying, talking about our failure to prepare really in time for World War II. He said, you know, when you have the time, you don't get the resources to prepare. And when you finally get the resources, you're out of time. And so I hope that we are responding in time. But of course, it's, you know, it would be even worse if we weren't responding at this point with improving defense. But you know who's not really investing enough in defense is us, Mr. Vice President, right? So
right.
I think the strength in President Trump's budget was it allowed for real growth of about 2.5% above inflation mm-hmm. for the next 5 years. That is no longer the case. It's actual reduction, and what's worse about that is that there is a bow wave of deferred modernization from the Obama years that we still haven't gotten over. So, I think the reason why the Biden administration hasn't put out its defense strategy yet or its national security strategy is because it was all about, hey, we only need to worry about China.
Right.
Well, actually, we have to worry about Russia too. We have to worry about Iran. We have to worry about North Korea. And not that we need massive defense spending, but how about just going back to historical levels, you know, of about 4% GDP? That would, I think, give us the resources we need, right, again, to prevent wars, what we really want to do.
Right. Peace through strength.
Absolutely.
H.R. McMaster, talking about the present moment, you know, it grieves my heart to see the images coming out of Ukraine. As vice president, I traveled into Estonia. I met with the leaders of Lithuania and Latvia. I traveled to Montenegro. I met with President Zelensky on several different occasions. Talk to us about what you're seeing of and hearing of this extraordinary and courageous defense that the Ukrainian people and President Zelensky are putting up at this hour.
Well, hey, Mr. Vice President, what I'm heartened by it, obviously, because what you see is you see people who are fighting and sacrificing to preserve their freedom.
Right.
And I think that's important, obviously, in terms of protecting Ukrainians, but I hope it's important to us. And I hope it gives us an opportunity here in the United States to cherish the freedoms that we enjoy. I'll tell you, Mr. Vice President, what I've seen in recent years is, you know, really a tendency towards what I would call self-flagellation, right? To point out every flaw in our society. And while we need, you know, a candid assessment of our shortcomings to improve, what I don't hear enough of is really people appreciating, you know, what we do have, the freedom of speech that we have, the freedom of expression, the tolerance of religion, and just being living in a democratic society in where we all have a say in how we're governed. Right. And how about rule of law and due process of law? And this is what the Ukrainian people aren't taking for granted. We shouldn't take it for granted either. And so we should do everything we can, I think, to live well and to cherish the freedoms that we enjoy. And obviously to ensure we do everything we can to work together, you know, across political lines and across all communities in our country to build a better future for generations of Americans to come. I'm hoping the Ukrainians can inspire us to do that.
It's very eloquent words and sage observations about the times in which we live. You know, our prayers at our house, and I know at yours and all over this country around the world, have been going out for the Ukrainian people. Last week, I was on national television a few times. I know you were. I said that the initial sanctions were too weak, that we ought to be sanctioning the entire financial sector in Russia. I also called on Friday for adding the SWIFT international payment program to the economic sanctions that were being imposed. And also, I think it's high time we recognize that the lifeblood of Russia is oil and gas exports. And as we sit here today, HR, we are not sanctioning any of their energy. In fact, there was a spokesman at the administration at the end of last week who wanted to assure people that none of the sanctions applied to Russian oil exports. Are we going far enough on sanctions? Do we need to add energy, oil, and gas coming out of Russia to the sanctions and essentially brace ourselves for whatever short-term impact of that is? Is that going to be the most effective way, and are we doing enough?
We're not doing enough. So the, you know, really the, you know, the export of hydrocarbons is 59% of Russia's exports. And that's the ATM machine that funds his war-making machine.
Right.
Germany imports 51% of its natural gas and 41% of its oil from, you know, from Russia. And Germany made a lot of really, really bad decisions on energy policy. They got rid of nuclear. They tried to leap immediately toward renewables, and they can't do it. They can't keep the lights on. And in fact, you know, the prices are through the roof, and German companies, these are aluminum and steel companies, are shutting down and selling their energy allocation because that's what's more profitable. And you know what's sad? That's the path we're on in the United States. How did it make sense to cancel a Canadian pipeline and greenlight a Russian one? How does it make sense to cancel pipelines that can distribute natural gas, which, by the way, the availability of cheap natural gas in the United States allowed for the greatest reduction in carbon emissions in history.
Right.
And then why did the president, as he gave his State of the Union address, which I think had a lot of positive aspects to it, he didn't mention the word nuclear. He didn't mention the words energy policy. And what we see, I think, are ideologically driven non-solutions to the interconnected problems of energy security, carbon emissions, climate change, and so forth.
Well, we achieved energy independence under our administration. First time in 70 years we were a net exporter of energy because of the oil and gas exploration, the boom, the development of a whole range of new energy sources. But you believe the time is now to impose sanctions on oil, gas, energy exports coming out of Russia.
Yes, and to do everything we can to make up for that, which, as you're alluding to, we can. Right. For example, with LNG, there are 20 actions and six really actions ready, pending at the Department of Energy, waiting for approval, bureaucratically sure. obstructed by the administration, that if they were lifted, we could begin to be a part of the solution to this problem. And yeah. and that's really what could, I think, more than anything else, maybe convince Russia that they can't sustain this effort if we go with the hydrocarbon sanctions.
As you know, like in your family, I've got a couple, a son and a son-in-law in active duty military. We recognize Ukraine is not a NATO ally. And the president has made it clear that we have no obligation to send American forces into this fight. But one of the things I was very proud in our administration that we did is after the Obama-Biden administration sent blankets and meals to Ukraine during their time, even in the wake of Crimea, we sent Stinger missiles. We sent arms. Are we doing enough now? Is Congress doing enough? Is the president doing enough to ship arms and military support to the Ukrainians as they defend their freedom?
I think now we are. I just hope it's not too late. As you mentioned, it was absolutely vital for us to help the Ukrainians with defensive capabilities, but just allowing them to buy those capabilities right. as well. But others were more reluctant. We saw that Germany for a long time actually obstructed the Ukrainians' ability to buy or import or receive donations of German weapons or weapons with German components. Well, they've lifted that, which is a big part of the shift that we've seen Germany make. We ought to give Chancellor Scholz credit for that. I mean, he's a member of the SPD party, which, as you know, has had an unnatural soft spot for the Russians for like a long time. And now I think he's convinced that they have to take more decisive action. And this connection is, as you mentioned already, too, with the increase in their own defense spending. So I think the trends are in the right direction. I just hope it's not too little too late. What right. we're going to see now, though, I think, and this is really, really important, is a humanitarian crisis, right? There are three elements of the Ukrainian resistance. There's Ukrainian armed forces. They're the territorial forces that we've seen, and they will fight, I think, to the end. But then you also have the population, and can the population continue to resist with enough popular will? Well, they're going to need pharma. They're going to need food. They're going to need water. And so I think we've got to do everything we can to keep the land routes open to come across the Polish border, the Romanian border, the Moldovan border. But we've got to really work, I think, with other countries to demand humanitarian corridors for maritime shipments and for airlifts into portions of Ukraine, at least. And I think that's the upcoming crisis. The next 8 days are going to be really critical, I think.
Well, it seems to me we almost need a Berlin airlift of humanitarian aid and of military support. We just, I saw commentary on television today from one of the reporters on the ground who said that actually the officials in Ukraine they're not asking anybody right now for troops. They're saying, send us arms so we can defend ourselves. But we haven't yet heard too many people talk, as you did, HR, about the humanitarian crisis. 500,000 refugees already have crossed the border into Poland. I give Poland, President Duda, great credit for the way they've opened their border and opened their hearts to people fleeing the violence. It's truly extraordinary and terrifically good points. On national television this weekend, before we let you go, you said that Putin got more than he bargained for. You created I think you kindled a little bit of hope and optimism among people around the country. Tell us what you mean by that. He ran into the full force of a President Zelensky who would not relent, would not flee. He ran into the tenacious and strong people of Ukraine who are a freedom loving, strong people. But as you said earlier, he also ran into an alliance among the West that not only was not in disarray, but more united than ever before. Are those among the things that you thought were more than he bargained
Absolutely.
For?
I think that's a perfect summary of it. He wanted disunity. He got unity. he wanted a leader who would flee. He probably looked at Zelensky and thought, this guy's a comedian, you know, he's a ballroom dancer. And, you know, Putin fancies himself as a tough guy, you know, as you know, a guy who practices judo and rides around on horseback bare chested. Right. And I think he underestimated President Zelensky. And I think what he did is he mirror imaged. Right. We often talk about the cognitive traps we fall into. But he was thinking of his own authoritarian regime, where as if he's gone, that regime collapses. He is the regime. Well, this is a democracy. And you know, he's fighting the entire Ukrainian people. He didn't bargain for that. He didn't understand that. And then I think he maybe believed the propaganda about his own forces. The Russian forces have demonstrated some real qualitative deficiencies in their leadership and their ability to fight effectively as a combined arms team.
Isn't there some evidence, too, that they've got logistics problems as well? I mean, would you see Russian tanks out of gas?
Absolutely.
Captured by citizens on their iPhones? It strikes me that you know, the much vaunted Russian military may not have been as organized as they posed to be. So he's run, in your mind, he's bitten off more than he could chew. But if we put the heavy sanctions on, if we continue to arm the Ukrainians, if we make sure to have the humanitarian aid in there. Where does this go? H.R. McMaster, before I let you go, where does this go, and what more can America and our allies do?
Well, I think there are three main possibilities, right? The first of these is that Russia's defeated, right? They did bite off more than they can chew. They realize that there's no way they can gain control of Ukraine, and they try to sue for peace to give him some kind of a cover, maybe to maintain, you know, the two territories in the east and get out and cut his losses. That's the best case scenario. It's still not a rosy scenario because of all the suffering of the Ukrainian people, and Ukraine will still be under Russia's thumb for anything subsequent. Right. The second of these is an escalation of the conflict, much larger than we've seen, maybe involving a NATO country, and maybe even an escalation to what we don't even want to think about, right? Which is the use of the most destructive weapons on Earth. And that's something we have to guard against and to ensure that the actions that we take are transparent, and that we work to take away the narrative that Putin's tried to use, that he's somehow like the victim of Western or NATO aggression. And then I think the third, which is sadly probably the most likely, is he won't be able to accomplish his objectives, and he won't give it up, in which case you're going to have a long conflict in Ukraine with the Ukraine people suffering, but also the Russians suffering continuing losses. I'll tell you, Mr. Vice President, there's no way he can control all of that country with the force he has arrayed, right? If it's 160, it's 180,000, you divide that on four axes, you take a look at the losses that he's already encountered. You take a look at really how cities swallow up armies in terms of the ability to control them. And without a cooperating indigenous population, I don't think he can do it. Now, he can make it very painful as we look at what's going on in Kharkiv right now. It looks like he may be trying to turn Kharkiv into Grozny. Remember when he leveled a city, Russians leveled a city when they invaded Chechnya. And of course, you know, we don't want to see that suffering, and we have to hold him accountable and responsible for the human rights, egregious human rights abuses of now clearly targeting civilian facilities and civilian populations.
Incisive analysis, eloquently stated as ever. And H.R. McMaster, I just want to thank you for joining us for American Freedom, but just thank you for a lifetime of being such a champion of freedom. And at such a time as this, I know that people that are listening and my family are grateful that you're out giving voice to this. And we will continue to hope and to pray for the best outcome, for a victory for the Ukrainian people, and a victory for freedom, to turn back this Russian aggression and send Putin and the Russian army packing back home with their tail between their legs. So help them God. So HR, thank you so much. Thanks for being with American Freedom. Again, HR McMaster is now at the Hoover Institution, former national security advisor in the Trump-Pence administration. Go to Amazon. Any book that bears his name as an author would be worth reading twice. HR, thanks so very much. God
bless.
Thank
you, Mr. Vice President. What a pleasure to be with you. Please give my best to your family. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.
I'm Larry O'Connor, talk radio host in Washington, D.C. on WMAL. In addition to my radio program, I have the distinct honor of being involved in Young America's Foundation as a speaker and member of YAF's National Journalism Center Board of Governors. As a father of college and soon-to-be college-age kids, I'm so proud of my affiliation with YAF. YAF is the principal youth outreach organization of the conservative movement. Every year, YAF introduces thousands of students to the ideas of free enterprise, individual freedom, a strong national defense, and traditional values. YAF hosts inspiring student conferences, brings leading conservative speakers like me to hundreds of high school and college campuses, and promotes activism initiatives with thousands of Young Americas for Freedom members across the country. The foundation also preserves President Reagan's beloved Rancho del Cielo in California and recently acquired the Ronald Reagan Boyhood Home in Illinois, ensuring the ideals of our 40th president carry on to the next generation. Friends, YAF is doing the work our high schools, colleges, and universities refuse to do, educating and inspiring the next generation with the values upon which our great nation was founded. To find out how you can get more involved with YAF or support their ongoing fight for freedom, head to YAF.org or call 800-USA-1776. That's YAF.org, 800-USA-1776.
Welcome back to American Freedom. Thanks again to H.R. McMaster for joining us at an enormously important time for the free world as the Russian military marches at this very hour across Ukraine, and the courageous people of Ukraine are fighting to defend their nation. But it's good to have you all with us today. Our conversation continues. This is Mike Pence, and I want to thank Young America's Foundation for sponsoring American Freedom, this podcast that now has been on the internet and available for the better part of 6 months, and I'm building a great audience that you are a part of, and we're truly grateful for that. Our next guest is an old friend of mine. Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano is currently vice president of Heritage Foundation. He runs the entire defense and foreign policy team at really the flagship think tank of the conservative movement. But more important than that, a 25-year Army veteran, a master's and doctorate from Georgetown University, and the author of many, many books. And I'm sure many of you have seen him on television in recent days, speaking eloquently and forcefully about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Jim Carafano, welcome to American Freedom.
Well, thanks, sir. Thank you for having me. You know, let me say, well, thank you, first of all, for jumping into the podcast world. You know, I think it's incredible when the government and media and universities and the pundits and everybody are telling Americans this is what's going on. And yet you look at the polling numbers and Americans know that none of this is right, whether it's inflation or the border or crime or any of these other issues. And you know, my theory is that's because they look around themselves and they know it isn't right. And they're going to the places where they can actually get information kind of unfiltered, talking. And so talk radio and podcasts, I think, have been the saviors of democracy, because I think that's where people are going and try to understand what's going on around them. So I think what you're doing and what's going on talk radio, I think you guys are the heroes of democracy, sir. So thank you.
It's very kind, Jim. Means a lot to me coming from you. And, you know, a lot of people don't know, I started my career in talk radio back in the 1990s. And when my team talked me into starting American Freedom with Young America's Foundation, I jumped at the chance. But you're right. Abraham Lincoln said, give the people the facts and the republic will be saved. And podcasts are doing that with conservative voices all across the country. Give us your general reaction, Jim. This podcast will be up literally 1 week to the day of the Russian invasion in Ukraine. Give us your broad reaction. Why now? Why did it happen now? Why didn't it happen, in your judgment, under the Trump-Pence administration? And what can the American people do, and what can the United States of America do to support the Ukrainian people in their fight for freedom?
You know, as a historian, and I know your deep love of history, you know, we used to cast aside the great man of history and said, no, you know, stop reading about generals and kings and stuff. And we need to talk about the common man. And that's been the flavor of the month really for decades. But yet This is a reminder that the decisions that leaders make have unbelievable consequences. So there are two individuals who have literally put millions of people at risk to the most horrible war you could possibly imagine that looks everything like the Siege of Warsaw in World War II or the Battle of Stalingrad. And that is, you know, Vladimir Putin and Joe Biden. As you know, I think in 2014, when Obama was president, Putin really decided that his dream could be realized. The notion that he could empower his kleptocracy forever and make it invulnerable by reabsorbing the post-Soviet states,
right,
having dictatorial control over Central Europe, having NATO collapse, having America withdrawn, be isolated, and that Europe was weak and divided, and Obama was actually distracted and leaving Europe. And now is the time to march. And that march continued, I think, until the day Donald Trump and you came into office, because whatever the rhetoric was, he very quickly, quickly realized that on the ground, this administration was not going to stand for that. And so he just sat in place for 4 years. And then the day Joe Biden came in, he looked at things like Afghanistan and Nord Stream 2 and flatlining defense spending.
And reopening the Iran nuclear deal.
Obama team.
Right.
And he said, he goes, now's the time to move. And so I think it's the consequence of those two forces coming together that got us right where we are. I'm sure HR was, you know, my former cadet was brilliant, you know, talking about, you know, what's going on in the war. I like to kind of step back and say, look, we need to continue to do everything we can to help the Ukrainian people. And we are in the phase of the war, which Putin's strategy is moved to just like Syria. He's just going to flatten and kill people until he conquers the country.
You said that in another interview just in the last couple of days, that I mean, the Ukrainian people are putting up an incredible fight. I had the chance to meet with President Zelensky at great length when the both of us were in Poland. I met him on several other occasions. I must tell you that I didn't know what to expect the first time that I met him. But when I met him, I could tell there was more there than meets the eye. He was often dismissed by the world as a comedian, a television personality, become president. But what I found in him was someone who was very engaging and showed a strength and a commitment to Ukraine that now everyone in the world sees. I mean, that I think his line about when the United States offered to fly him out, he said, I need ammunition. I don't need a flight. Will go down in history as among the courageous statements made by the leader of a country in the free world. But the Ukrainians are putting up this incredible battle. And the American people now, Jim, we're praying, but we also are wanting to, we're seeing armaments go in, we're seeing resources go in, we're wanting to see more sanctions. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But you said that what you would anticipate is that Russia would essentially try and do this the way Assad did in Syria, and that is just, if all else fails, just blanket destruction across the country. Tell us why you see that as a prospect for Putin, and what's the best way to prevent it?
Well, I don't think he sees losing as an option, and as debilitating it is to his economy, and as debilitating the war is going to be, and as massive the problems are he's going to have when he's done, he seems committed to this. You know, he said that this is a war of liberation and he was stopping an ethnic genocide, yet they just actually pummeled a city into the dust, which was entirely ethnically Russian. So he's literally killing the people that he says he's there to liberate. So
Ukraine says 2,000 civilians have died.
You know, and we should say too, and I know this is important to you, governments can do a lot of things, but there's a lot of refugees out there. There's a lot of people still at risk. There's a lot of way that we can help. There's some tremendous organizations. You know them well. One is Spirit of America, spiritofamerica.org, fantastic organization that goes in harm's way with former military veterans to help people out. Samaritan's Purse, which is a fantastic relief organization. The Ukrainian IRGC, not the Red Cross, but the Ukrainian Red Cross, which are the guys on the ground in Ukraine. So those are some places where we can go right to
right now,
and they will help get people help.
Right.
I think that we also have to focus on recognize that regardless of how this ends, this is the crisis before the next crisis. He can go to Moldova. He can go to Georgia. Eventually he can challenge Article 5. And we have to ask, how do we stop him? And I think the really important point here is to remember that Putin is China's stalking horse. Putin is doing China's work for it. China would like nothing more than a weakened and destabilized and distracted Europe that pushes America and isolates America. So a win for Putin is a win for China. And we have to ask, how do we stop Russia? Because that's actually also part of the fight of dealing with China.
Of containing China. Right. Exactly. 100%. But you said it was very provocative to me. You said actually, because Putin was assuming disunity in the West, that it and disunity in the United States, that he was assuming we wouldn't marshal the free world together, that he was assuming President Zelensky, I think he was assuming President Zelensky would and his government would be easily toppled. He was assuming he could push. None of that is happening. President Zelensky is standing firm, a profile in courage. The Ukrainian people are fighting in the streets, standing in front of tanks. And the West, Jim, you and I have known each other a long time. I mean, to see NATO stepping up, to see Germany announce, Chancellor Scholz announce Germany is finally going to live up to their commitment to our common defense and spend 2% of their GDP on common defense. Now they're making weapons available. Putin has run into a buzzsaw of opposition in Ukraine and opposition in the free world. But you said with China backing him in effect and endorsing his action here, you said now China's got a Russia problem. So what did you mean by that? And put this all in that context you just described, kind of the larger kind of geopolitical challenges facing the United States in the years ahead.
Yeah. So, and I give all credit, you know, again, it's the great person here. The credit for this goes to Putin and Zelensky. Let's be honest. If Zelensky had not put up a fight and this had ended in 48 hours, like Putin expected, the West would have tried to look for a way to get past this. But because the Ukrainians are fighting.
He must have thought that Zelensky was going to do what Ghani did in Afghanistan.
Exactly.
Right. Get on a plane and go. And then the government collapses. Fighting,
and because the Russians have demonstrated, Putin has demonstrated how truly evil he is. Right. I think he's just scared the hell out of all of us. And when you see the Chinese enabling, empowering, and backing them, they realize that this is a squeeze play. China from one side and Russia from the other. And I think, but I'm sorry, you know me, I'm not partisan. I don't even belong to a political party. I do vote, but it's not Joe Biden that's leading the charge here. It is Zelensky that's leading the charge. And Biden is the bystander in chief drifting along. But having said that, Zelensky has given us better than we deserve. I mean, 44 million Ukrainians, like the guys at the Alamo, have given the rest of us a chance to get our act together. And in this Russia-China alliance, how do we take Russia off the table? There's only two things that make Russia a problem.
Okay, go.
Military and energy.
Right.
The military part's easy. Conventional and strategic deterrence. Europeans do their part.
Right.
We do our part.
We have the ability, peace through strength. Right. Well, H.R. McMaster just said, you know, the unfortunate, and I appreciate you are not a partisan. People need to know that you stay above the fray and put national defense first. But people deserve to know the Biden administration is actually cutting military spending after we'd spent 4 years rebuilding the military, backfilling from years of budget cuts. And so they're literally going there. But you're saying you can deal with the conventional and the nuclear challenge by simply building up our military strength. But yeah, but go to your second point. Go to your second point, because on energy, On energy, there is a real vulnerability. During our administration, the United States achieved energy independence for the first time in 70 years. We were a net exporter of energy. The Biden administration has shut that down. Leave that debate over here for a second. Talk to us about the vulnerability of Russia if we did what you've advocated, what I've advocated, others have advocated, that President Biden said nothing about in a State of the Union address, but that is impose sanctions on Russia's oil and gas and energy exports.
Yeah, so if you think about it, if he can't threaten us militarily, because NATO does exactly the kind of things that your administration pressed for, and in some ways, Putin is finishing your job for you. He's got the Germans, he got the Germans to finally do what you wanted. But think about, but then if you do that, and then also, if you're not buying Russian energy, now that doesn't necessarily mean that Russia won't make money. They'll sell it to China. But if we are energy independent and we have reliable, abundant, affordable energy, the price of oil is going to go down.
Price goes down.
So, you know, Biden essentially has paid for Putin's war on Ukraine by having ridiculous energy policies because we cannot fill that demand. The price skyrocketed, and that increase in price has helped basically funded Putin's war. Now, conversely, if we are energy independent and we are in the marketplace and we're putting energy out there, OPEC and Russia, they can't keep the price high. That means that he's going to make less money. The other thing it does is, and this is really crucial, is he can't do what's called energy blackmail. Let's be honest, if we had done today what we threatened to do 9 months ago, if we had pushed arms, all of us, into Ukraine, medical supplies and food and defensive, and if we had immediately opted for heavy sanctions, Putin might have never marched. But he did. There's no do-overs in history. But the point is the reason why that was because if you were an Italian or a Hungarian or a German, you are worried about what's called energy blackmail. The fact that in the middle of winter, Putin would cut off the gas and your people would freeze to death and your factories would stop. And that was just unacceptable. And so it's that threat of energy blackmail that made Europeans reluctant to stand up and do the things that would deter Putin. So if we don't want that to happen again, we have to take energy blackmail off the table. And the only way to do that
is such a great point.
Energy abundance. And this gets to the real crucial issue, because the two things that we did not hear in the State of the Union address was we did not hear a commitment to stronger defense and peace restraint.
No, right.
And we heard nothing about an energy policy. We heard we're going to release basically 3 days of oil from the strategic stockpile.
Right.
And immediately after the speech, the price of oil went up. And that and completely erase the value of that extra oil in the marketplace. To get to where you guys were, Biden is going to have to do something that he just doesn't want to do, which is the idea of a responsible energy policy that makes sense in terms of geopolitics completely conflicts with a climate agenda, which is myopically committed to eliminating fossil fuels, pushing renewables, and really defying the law of physics. I mean, it's a political agenda. It's not really a green transformation agenda. And look, I just sat with we had 12 embassies that were our guests at CPAC. I won't tell you who they are, but many of them were not actually very conservative governments, but it was really interesting on our climate discussions, because they totally get the threat of Putin. But when you talk to them about, okay, energy policy, they just can't let go of this climate agenda. But this is the key geopolitical challenge that we face today. If we cannot reconcile climate action with an energy policy that makes sense for our economy and geopolitics.
Right, for national security. It's Jim Carfano is with us, folks. He is the vice president of Heritage Foundation. Joining us on American Freedom today. Jim, before we let you go, people can go to heritage.org to keep track of all the good work that you and the National Defense and Foreign Policy team are putting out. We'll make sure there's a link with this podcast. But let me ask you what I asked H.R. McMaster. I mean, you're a historian, distinguished military career. You followed these events for many decades that we've known each other. The American people are praying for the people of Ukraine. We're inspired by them. I think there is broad support for military arms that we're providing, and I believe on increasing measure. I think the American people would join you in a chorus calling for greater sanctions, including on energy, humanitarian aid. We may well need a Berlin airlift to provide the humanitarian aid that could be necessitated in the wake of this evil and cruel Russian invasion. But from your chair, from your perspective, where does this go? Where does this end? What should we prepare ourselves for, pray for, or realistically hope for in turning back the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
There's a great guy that works for me, General Tom Spohr, really distinguished military officer. You know, we have this, our own media website's called the Daily Signal. He just wrote a terrific article there that looks at, and we war game this yesterday, the five or six different scenarios of the way this could turn out. And he showed them to me, and I said, and I just pointed to one, and I said, it's that one. And honestly, I mean, this is just a candid military assessment. Putin is going to occupy this country after a very ugly and bloody war. But the result of that is going to be, it's going to cost him way more than he thought. He's going to have a country that is going to be very, very difficult to occupy, that will be a restive and popular, and it'll be destroyed, right? So all the infrastructure will be crushed. So they will have to feed and house people. It's going to be a real burden. The Chinese are not going to bail them out. The cost, between the cost of the collapsing Russian economy and this war and occupation, they don't have enough money to make Russia whole. So Putin, I think, is going to have to go into a strategic pause. Now, having spent this blood and treasure, does anybody really believe that Putin will be satisfied? No, that's not how Russians are. So they're going to go for Moldova. They're going to go for Georgia. They're going to do something in the Balkans. And then at some point, they're going to go after Article 5. They're going to go for a country, one country.
Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania.
Doesn't matter. And they're going to prove that NATO won't come to their defense and force the force Article 5 to fail and then watch NATO collapse. So we have a short breathing space here to get our act together on defense. I think three things, right? One is defense. One is to rapidly move towards a sane energy policy. And the other is we've got to get our economic house in order. We cannot continue to have spiraling debt and runaway inflation.
Right.
So we need to get back to responsible fiscal spending. We need to take all the ridiculous red tape off, let people get back to work. Literally everything Biden said in the State of the Union address, if it was enacted, would literally flatten this economy like a heart attack. We've got to go in the opposite direction. We've got to go back to what we were doing just 2 years ago. Real low unemployment, because people are fully employed, low inflation, lowering the debt, and then unleashing the economy for real growth, because that'll pay for the defense. That will pay for the energy transition. If we take whatever time we have to rewrite our policy, we can do that. But if we just, when this is over, just say, oh, we stopped, we're done, and drift back to what we were doing before, or we don't use the pause that we have. And it's not only important for Russia, it's equally important for China. People say, well, they saw this guy take Ukraine, then they'll just take Taiwan. Look, they don't need Russia. They don't need a lesson from Russia to decide when they're going to go after Taiwan when they can. But the Chinese and the Russians are exactly right. They react to what we do, not what we say.
Right.
So if China sees us build up our defense and our economy and our energy, they will be afraid. And that's what we want.
Very well said. Really powerful comments. Jim Carafano, I just can't thank you enough for being with us today. I said last week, I think I was on Sean Hannity's program, I said, it's time for less talk, more action. Rebuilding our military and putting America back on a path of energy independence, putting our own fiscal house in order and getting our economy rolling again. Tremendous prescription for peace through strength. And I believe with all my heart, Jim, that there was no coincidence that after Russian military moved into Georgia in 2008, the Bush administration, and the military moved into Crimea when Joe Biden was vice president in 2014, that during our 4 years, our commitment to our military, our commitment to energy independence, our willingness to use force when Syria crossed the red line and we fired the cruise missiles, our willingness to take on ISIS, take down Baghdadi, take down Soleimani, and even confront and destroy Russian mercenary military in Syria who moved against our forces, all sent a message of unambiguous strength that was a deterrent to Putin moving forward on what we now have seen once again have always been his ambition in the course of his life. Here's someone that said the collapse of the Soviet Union was I think he described it as the worst tragedy of the 20th century. And he believes that. And everyone in the sound of my voice, I hope you're listening very intently to Jim Carafano about where we need to go as a country to put ourselves back on a path where we will continue to be the world's shining light for freedom. And it's also the very best hope for the people of Ukraine. We'll pray for them. We'll stand with them. We'll provide them with military support. We'll provide them with the resources they need, humanitarian and otherwise. But at the end of the day, the best thing we can do for Ukraine, Jim, to your point, is to be a strong America and back them in their fight and send an unambiguous message to Putin, to China, to North Korea, that the free world stands together and we're going to defend freedom wherever it's challenged. Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, folks, is the vice president at Heritage Foundation. You should go to heritage.org or go to the Daily Signal online to keep up with all of Jim's work. Jim, thank you for your long lifetime of service. Your voice has maybe never been more important than it is right now in the national debate. And I'm just really honored to have you on American Freedom with us.
Thank you, sir. God bless.
This is former vice president with the Young America's Foundation and American Freedom. We'll see you next time.